Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. Except for this week, we are only picking over the pop culture that everyone is picking over this week. Yes, it is all Star Wars all the time this week. The Pop Rocket is awakening. With me to talk exclusively and in full spoiler fashion about Star Wars The Force Awakens, our academic and DJ Oliver Wang.
Hey, Guy.
Hello, Oliver. How you doing?
I'm good.
Pop Rocket's fifth Beatle, primus inter pares of all of our guest co-hosts, USC professor Karen Tongson.
Hello, Guy.
Hello, Karen. And we're not going to get a hello, hello. It's very, Josh, you have to hello, hello now, okay?
Okay.
And comedian and TV writer Josh Greenberg.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, Josh.
Did that work?
Yes. Cool. Both Oliver and I have known Josh since Berkeley days.
In fact, Everyone in here was at Berkeley at the same time. Oh, wow. We didn't all know each other at that point.
Really?
Wow.
So this is very Cal Bears up in here.
Go
right now.
Bears.
So we're really not like coming through on that whole diversity thing this week.
Not collegiately, no.
Every week we start the show by taking a question from a listener about our own pop culture taste. This week I want you to tell me, which Star Wars universe character are you? Karen Tongson.
Well, the part of me that likes to flatter my butch masculinity would say Han Solo, because I'm a little bit sleazy, a little bit dodgy. My politics are somewhat suspect. But in the end, I'm most likely R2-D2.
Why?
Because I'm a bit squat and I can be helpful and also really entertaining at a party. But, you know, I also really was into Admiral Akbar. Back in 1983, I had a Sears Admiral Akbar sweatshirt. And there was something about his stateliness. Maybe that was a Madam Secretary in me, like wanting to come out, like identifying with the
animal. There's something so funny about those characters who sort of like coalesced as memes in our adulthood, but who you were sort of like preoccupied with as a child. Admiral Akbar, possibly chief amongst them. Oliver.
Yeah. I did not realize this until recently, but Akbar's species or race are called the Mon Calamari.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, how tacky is that? Yeah.
And their ships are based on pickles. Oliver, who would you be from Star Wars?
So I think much like Karen, if I were to flatter myself, I would want to imagine myself as Obi-Wan being, you know, very sage, enigmatic, and unflappable, except momentarily in the wake of planetary genocide. But who I probably am actually is C-3PO, which is to say clunky and kvetching and a know-it-all, who would like to think of himself as helpful with, you know, your 6 million apparently useless forms of language capabilities, and mostly just gets in the way of everyone else. So, yeah.
Oh, poor C-3PO. Like, I'm always going to be annoyed by the person who follows rules and, you know, tries to be helpful, being seen as like the dumb killjoy. Josh, who are you?
Well, I guess I'm a little bit torn. I kind of want to say Salacious Crumb because that guy just has a great job.
Who was Salacious Crumb?
Oh, Salacious Crumb is the little monster who sits next to Jabba the Hutt and just basically...
Oh, yeah.
He cackles a lot.
Yeah, he cackles. He is Jabba's hype man, basically. Right. So he just gets to sit there, laugh at jokes. But then I think I also am a little bit the guy who owned the Rancor monster.
Yes.
Big animal lover. Likes to just walk around shirtless. So that's me in a
nutshell.
Wow,
yeah.
I am a hard, solid Mon Mothma. Like the minute in Return of the Jedi when we saw that there was an administrative official who just made sure that, like, you know, all the papers got pushed, I was like, who's she and where can I get a sensible short red haircut? Thanks to, oh, Jamie Duner. My Jamie Duner, I work with on Awkward, he gave this question to us. Thanks to Jamie Duner in the Facebook group for that question, and shout out to Lauren and Charlie. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back to talk Star Wars after the break.
Hey, I'm Barbara Gray.
I'm Brandi Posey.
And I'm Tess Barker.
Together, we make up the Max Fun podcast, Lady to Lady.
Each week, we welcome a kick-ass lady guest.
We talk about our lives, our dreams, and the terrible decisions we've made that still haunt us.
Mm-hmm. We've had on great comedians like Aisha Tyler and Margaret Cho, plus screenwriters, doctors, authors, you know, anyone who's willing to be as open as we are.
It's all a lot of fun. That's us, Lady to Lady.
Can you keep a secret? Neither.
Thank you. Welcome back to Pop Rocket, where we are talking about Star Wars in full spoiler fashion. So if you haven't seen the film and want to have its precious cargo brought to you directly from J.J. Abrams, turn this off and go listen to a nice stuff you missed in history class. With me to talk about everything Star Wars are...
Karen Tongson.
Josh Greenberg.
And Oliver Wang.
And guys, what are our reactions? What are our thoughts? Oliver.
All right, so here's the thing. I went to see it twice. The first night was on Thursday night, which was the big premiere night. We went to the Arclight with my wife and daughter. And I came out of it feeling sort of disappointed by the experience. And I think partly it's because my expectations were really insanely high, even though I probably should have known to keep it lower. So then I went back the next day on Friday morning and rewatched it again.
Why were you disappointed?
I think what I wanted the movie to do was to basically transport me back to being a five-year-old watching Star Wars in the theater for the first time in 1977. And there's no way it could do that because I'm not five anymore. And so I think what I wanted every scene to be sort of this transcendent gut punch of euphoria, like, oh my God, this is amazing. And there's no possible way this film could ever achieve that.
Okay. When I was a seven-year-old little boy at the State Theater in Yuba City, California, I watched Return of the Jedi. And about three-quarters of the way through, they're talking about the possibility of Luke failing. And Yoda says, there is another. And just the notion that a girl could be a Jedi was so much to me, was so overwhelming to me. That, like, it just thrilled my imagination. Like, the movie gave me none of that. And then the whole time I was watching the prequels, I was just waiting for the moment when we were going to get some sort of, like, tertiary character who would at least satisfy a little bit of that for me, and nothing. And when I realized that The Force Awakens is There Is Another The Movie, mm-hmm. I was a seven-year-old boy again. I was like, oh, shit. Like, this is happening. This is not something that I want so much and is just never, like, I don't deserve. Like, it's going to happen. That movie is so much a retread of A New Hope. And I cannot blame J.J. Abrams one bit for doing that. Both to get the taste of the prequels out of our mouths and to relay the tread so that we would be able to accept these new characters who are outside of the boundaries of what we think of for this world, like within the world. Karen?
No, I mean, I was really excited. Obviously, but Daisy Ridley was amazing and I was really into her. But, you know, when I went to see it, I didn't buy tickets in advance. I made sure to go to a theater where I had to line up and get the tickets, the Vista Theater in Hollywood, Los Feliz. And so it sort of recreated that experience for me when I lined up at the Tylan Mall in Riverside waiting for Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, the Vista is a real movie theater. It's a big movie house.
It's a big movie house. Well, you know, we lined up, we waited for a long time to get in. And I think that anticipation, like, really kind of fluffed my experience of it, too, right? Like, it wasn't that sort of mediated, oh, I'll get my tickets, like, 2 weeks in advance and I'll show up. And, you know, honestly, I also wanted to be more sort of thrilled or awakened. I wanted my force to be awakened.
Yeah.
But what I appreciated about it was that, you know, as you were saying, getting the bad taste of the prequels out of our mouths was that the kind of special effects universe that this film that The Force Awakens provides is actually a very quaint special effects universe that isn't, you know, like everything nowadays beyond like the kind of Star Wars franchise too is just like explosion upon explosion upon like it's a sensory overload. And there's something really kind of Galaga, the video game, about.
Well, as an academic who specializes in normcore, there was something so interesting about just waiting 40 years for those fashions to come back so that we could just put people in, like,
the tunics.
In the rebel uniform and have fucking buttons.
Yeah.
Like, the sheer number of glowing buttons and how much it didn't feel awkward. It felt more right than the green screen universe of the prequels.
Absolutely. And even General Leia's age-appropriate linen ensembles were really totally amazing.
I mean, the one moment where I was a little bit pulled out was her last outfit, and I was like, Space Talbots. Where?
Space Talbots.
Ouch.
Where do, like, moms shop in space?
But she had that Space Talbot vest tailored, obviously.
No, it was great. All right, Josh. People on the Pop Rocket don't know you that much. I should have introduced you better before.
That's okay.
Lay out your nerd cred before us, please.
Oh, sure. Well, I've been a Star Wars fan forever, first of all. I may or may not have a collection of Star Wars action figures hidden away. but I'm a writer, written for Raising Hope and a couple other shows, now writing for Crowded. And I love sci-fi and horror and stuff.
What was your reaction to the movie? What was your...
What is that what you meant by my nerd cred?
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
Like, can I interject something? I mean, Josh and I know each other because we were roommates my sophomore year, his freshman year at Berkeley. And he had a Laserdisc player and the Laserdisc version of Aliens, which I'd never seen all the extras and deleted scenes. So this kind of gives you just a sense of, as a college freshman, he had a Laserdisc player and sci-fi films on Laserdisc. And that was my introduction to Josh.
Yep. And by the way, Laserdisc is totally coming back. It really is. People miss the ability to turn over a disc every half hour. Okay, what was my impression? I really, really enjoyed it upon first seeing it. And as the days go by, I'm starting to feel that kind of, oh, seeing the little flaws. But that said, still, after the prequels, such a relief to have real characters and humor and real emotion and not a lot of discussion about taxation and Senate debates.
Okay. A couple of things. First of all, the thing that always bothered me about the prequels is that for all of this discussion of trade routes and Senate debates, George Lucas never understood how those things worked. He wanted to understand how they worked, but it's not like he ever rooted this in a world that, like, made political sense or had a point to it. He just named a character Newt Gunray, and we were supposed to think that that was, like, political satire.
Aspirational allegory.
He also – that world also had a queen who was voted into being a queen.
After being in the youth legislature.
Right.
But I was really struck. I thought after what J.J. Abrams had done with the Star Trek reboot, I loved the boldness of his saying, we're in a different timeline. Everything will be different here in the Star Trek movies. But I also felt like he didn't understand how to – he made them young and sexy and didn't understand how to play with campiness and corniness. And – Karen and I have had many conversations about the nature of corniness. But I really was excited that you did get the tastes of humor and that they were so nicely divorced from what passed as humor in the prequels. Like, there were so many CGI characters that were bad racial stereotypes in those prequels or just sort of like – just terrible. Like,
I mean, if I can just make an sort of an obvious observation, not just about our discussion, about the general reaction to the film, it's that part of what we wanted from this new film is that we wanted to forget the prequels. We wanted someone to return us back to the world building that Lucas did so effectively with New Hope back in 1977. And if J.J. Abrams did nothing else with this film, he shows that he competently understands what was appealing about that world and gave us that world. Maybe a little too much because it was – I mean, you described it as a remake of the first film. And really, it was kind of an amalgamation of all of the first original trilogies. I think that's one of the flaws. We can get into it. But nonetheless, he understood this is what people want from it. They want the tactile sense. They want a sense of, like, actual kind of, like, human characters and all the CGI shit. And I think what's going to be interesting is now that we've established, okay, we can forget about the prequels now because we have someone who understands the original world, where do we go from there with it?
Well, the gesture of having so many aliens be played by people wearing a thing on their head.
Right, practical effects. Yeah.
Practical effects. Yeah. I think if anyone had attempted to do that for episode one, they would have been like, what the fuck are you doing? Mm-hmm. And now we completely understood, like, just do that for a while. That for a while. And yes, in episode two, you can have a CGI character, but and his, like, the gentle gestures of, like, the CGI scrap merchant was like, especially after having had such a, like, semi-terrible scrap merchant in the prequels was a nice sort of showing, like, well, I can do this. I'm competent at it, but I'm not going to push too hard because you guys are scared.
I'm sorry. When you say episode one, you mean episode seven?
No, I mean The Phantom Menace.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Got it. Okay.
Yeah, I'm talking about Sabulba.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The
the vaguely hook-nosed.
Yes. So, like, let's get to – well, let's just talk about the fact that this movie, this gigantic, gigantic movie, managed to pull off a solid bait and switch on who the Jedi was. That
yes, the trailers were a very interesting red herring campaign to all make us think it's Finn. And no, it's Rey.
Yeah, it was putting that like lightsaber into his hand those two times. Very interesting. Like, are non-force sensitive people able to use a lightsaber? Do we have solid data on that?
I don't know.
That is a really good, because I was thinking that while I was
it's a fucking
it.
Light sword. Like, how much training do you need to have to figure out how to work light sword?
But he worked it pretty well. I mean, you know.
It makes you wonder if he is, like, force sensitive. Like, there was something interesting about the way they were talking about, like, oh, no, there's an awakening. Like, shit's going on. Like, maybe mm-hmm. there are sort of, like, Jedis popping up in the way that they're used to be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, there's some – this is – weird, but there's some canon that says that people who are not Jedi cannot wield a lightsaber.
Like they literally cannot pick it up?
I think so.
Like
but
it's
of course,
Excalibur.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, sword
now,
in
of
the
course,
stone.
We've seen Han Solo wield a lightsaber when he had to cut that Tauntaun open.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So apparently non-Jedi can wield it.
It's a laser sword. How can you not pick it up?
Right.
But
right.
Were you – well, I
– well, you can turn it on and pick it up, I thought, but I didn't think that you'd be able to wield it very expertly or well. That was my thought.
Especially against Kylo Ren. We'll get to Kylo Ren. But what were your thoughts on the fact that they legit managed to – if you showed up early enough and didn't listen to this podcast, didn't know that the girl was going to be the Jedi?
I mean, you figure she had to – I mean, you knew she was going to plan prominently, and the speculation was – and I think partly because she was white is that, oh, she must be either Leia and Han's kid or Luke's kid, but she must have some familiar connection in a way that no one assumed Finn was because, you know, he's not white.
Right.
And so you knew she was going to be prominent, whether she was going to be a Jedi or not. I didn't think the assumption is that she's not one. I think it's that we just were led to believe it's all about Finn. And in the end, which kind of builds up the big reveal that it's, oh, no, she's the one who's got the Force powers.
I honestly assumed that they were going to give us scrappy girl who can wield a blaster of the sort we've seen. Basically, the strong female character we have gotten, very much the Black Widow model of she's in there with the boys.
Yeah.
But the notion of her being sort of like the chosen and possessed of powers that were like equal to like – that she's not just going to punch the female enemy. There's that scene in, like, Superman 2 where, like, Lois Lane punches that one girl from Krypton.
Ursa.
Yeah, the girl from Krypton.
And it's like, I remember being so angry at that with, like, no, she has Superman powers. Why are you just making the girl punch her?
Right. No, she's definitely the lead. I mean, they sort of tricked us. Rey is, I believe, the lead of these new movies.
Yeah.
Which is pretty awesome.
And she's an amalgam, but to your point, she's really Han and Luke or Han or Leia and Luke merged into one, which is to say that I mean she's the new Han Solo. Like that's very clear at the end of the film, but she's also like the new Luke too.
I love the way they sliced up those three characters and divided them between Oscar Isaac, Finn, and Rey. Mm. It was like a really interesting series of choices. And also let's talk about the one of the popular criticisms online of Rey has been that she is a Mary Sue, that she is too good at everything, that she is just sliding into a canon. And Mary Sue is a reference to fan fiction that is just a lightly fictionalized version of a female author going in and being good at everything and then having either Spock, McCoy, or Kirk fall in love with her. What are your thoughts on this criticism?
There's a pretty kind of gross sexist tinge to saying she's a Mary Sue, mm-hmm. don't you think?
Well, yes.
I mean, it's weird. I mean, she is capable and she's, you know, strong and a badass. And I guess that's why people find fault. I mean, I think
– because that's not possible.
Right. I mean, maybe my only complaint is that her arc was so epic that, as someone said, it was as though they – compacted the entire first trilogy as though Luke was fighting Darth Vader at the very end. I mean, she basically fought the most badass, you know.
But the Kylo Ren is no Darth Vader.
That's true. Yeah. That is
like,
true.
The thing I deeply love is that first trilogy gave us a princess we had never seen before. Like a Jewish American princess with like a little bit of snark and a little bit of attitude, but who was like in the fucking game. And then you gave us Natalie Portman, like who was had a tough road to hoe. I mean, when you see those scenes of her in front of just a green screen, it's like, I get it. But it was trying to Westchesterify our Jewish American princess too hard, and there was no scrappiness left. And that this trilogy is giving us a Jewish American prince who is pissed off, like that he doesn't have the best toys and isn't the bestest ever, and that all of his classes and training may not have made him as good as Grandpa. Like, Kylo Ren is just like the glorious gift of this trilogy.
I thought Driver did a great job. I like the idea that he's conflicted and that there is actual some depth to it, and they're not trying to play him like the new Vader in a way that they don't. We've seen. I mean, the problem is with this film is there is so much recycling. But I'm glad this is one area where they didn't try to recycle kind of a straight up stoic, impenetrable bad guy who takes three films for there to be real conflict internally.
Also, it's 2015.
You get that from Jump.
Yeah.
We don't accept impenetrable bad guys anymore.
That's true.
Well, he's the, you know, reconstituted masculinity in a Vader outfit, right?
Talk us through that.
You know, but it is precisely that it is part of the kind of national struggle about, like, the topic of masculinity. It's sort of like, you know, how masculinity copes with its woundedness, with trying to be better, with trying to not be precisely like impenetrable, et cetera. And do you either run to the kind of extreme masculinity that I suppose Grandpa Vader represents?
Yeah.
Or do you try to find some new, more spiritual way of kind of cultivating whatever masculine power is going to be? And I thought it was amazing stunt casting, actually.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
to have Adam from Girls this guy. Because I mean, I couldn't help but think about his character on Girls, who is at once a total dick and then also the kind of, well, but he's, you know, has a really sweet soft side inside, you know, within
yeah.
and like he really kind of represents that post-millennial male, I think, right now. In the popular landscape, so.
And I legit forgot that he was in the movie. Like, there were so many people who you knew were in the movie that, like, by the end, I had to be like, wait, who was Lupita Nyong'o? But, like, when the mask came off, I was legit like, oh, yeah, he's in this movie.
And also, I don't think we can overlook the fact that he had just great hair.
Yeah.
Great. Oh, the hair, yeah.
It was a really beautiful, feathered kind of 1970s thing. I really enjoyed it.
Also, putting us in, like, snow in the mountains, in the forest, so simultaneously gave you, like, nice Nazi-ness, but also, like, samurai movie,
yes.
like, yeah. Sword fight. But back to you, Rey, as Mary Sue. Point I want to make is, I think that J.J. Abrams, interestingly, was echoing The Phantom Menace a tiny bit. Like, if you, like, Anakin, like, was more magically better at everything than any, like, it's why that movie was terrible, because that child accidentally defeated the invasion of Naboo, like, without knowing what he was doing. And there are some interesting touches of what she experiences leaving fake Tatooine. That sort of
Jakku.
Like, okay. Jakku be itself.
All right. To me, that's almost the hokiest and weirdest choice, was to put her on a Tatooine that wasn't Tatooine.
Well, everything was there was a not Tatooine, a not Hoth,
yeah.
and a
not Death Star.
Not Death Star. Yeah. It was.
Do we know clearly that wasn't Yavin?
Yeah. I don't think it was.
Okay.
Because I think it'd be stupid to have the same rebel base in the same planet for 40 years running. Because like the jig is up, like they know where it is.
Yeah. Right.
But sorry, I interrupted.
No, not at all. It was just so odd that it's almost like comfort food, that everything had this sort of familiar tone to it for better and worse, you know? I mean,
but I'm always going to defend that as like there being a little bit of female protagonist broccoli on a spoon and having to make the plane fly into the hangar for all of the fanboys.
Sure.
But Ray, I mean, I also think that the way they established Ray's character, at least for me, it was really satisfying because she obviously had cultivated these skills living hard in the desert, right? You know, it's not like she was just hanging out and then someday like one day heard voices in her head and then started moving shit, like, you know, with her brain. It was, she was like, you know, toughing it out and, you know, scrapping by, only drinking driblets of water and living off the weird puffy bread stuff. The, you know, so I think that the, even though her Jedi arc seemed accelerated towards the end of the film, I think that the first third at least established that these skills were hard won and that, you know, she's, you know, an independent woman.
Well, I mean,
I bought it,
compare,
you know?
Compare this with Neo in The Matrix, right? It's a very similar arc where Neo is a fucking badass by the end of it. And no one's like, oh, that doesn't seem realistic because you kind of – it's a sci-fi film. You sort of have to suspend a certain amount of disbelief. And I didn't feel like her arc was any less realistic than like a thousand other films in which we see a male protagonist going from zero to hero in 90 minutes.
Back to your point about Kylo Ren, I loved that they made him particularly good at telepathic aspects of the Force. Mm-hmm. It's such a girl thing to be good at. And like, Oliver's looking with doubt.
Oh, I don't know.
The number of like,
intuition, intimacy, getting into people's heads.
Female superheroes who are empaths are a dime a dozen. It is not something that blows people up. It helps you to learn about other people. And he uses it in a very, like, creepy, rapey way.
Yeah, that's what I was
I feel like it is just, like, another interesting gesture to undermine the, like, badass he wants to be. Like, that he's – that what he's a badass about is learning about other people. let's talk about Finn. Like, being on the inside of a stormtrooper transport – was just such a lovely shift in perspective. Mm-hmm. Like, forcing us to ask ourselves, who are these people who have been, we've just looked at as masks for...
As clones.
As clones. and I really loved that he had a very Han-ish sort of like, just get me out of here, I don't want to have to deal with this. And he kept getting pulled back in. Thoughts?
Well, we were talking about this a little bit beforehand. My one teeny tiny gripe is that he was pretty much the worst pacifist ever. His expression of, oh my God, I just saw my friend get killed and I don't want to have any part in any more killing, was to kill more of his stormtrooper friends. You know, I mean, I get it. It's that he was joining the rebellion and that
the resistance.
The resistance. See, again, not rebellion. And that involved killing some stormtroopers. But it was an odd kind of pacifism. But he was, I mean, it was very, very cool to see a noble stormtrooper.
Well, there's something so interesting about these movies in that, like, with Star Trek, you just had so many hours of stuff telling you about how the world worked. And, like, we know nothing about... in what context Finn was raised. Like, wait, wasn't he programmed to just be a killing machine all of his life? Where did he suddenly get conscience from? And also, in any way, understanding what the First Order is and the way that this is a successor state to the Empire is just like, I would like to know more, but I feel like in the course of, honestly, 3 more hours of movie, I'm probably not going to learn that much.
And I think they're trying to avoid the midichlorian, you know,
never heard the word midichlorian was so such a blessing.
Except, and this is one of my, I think, legit nitpicks, is that I think this film tried to avoid the kind of – it stayed in science fantasy and didn't try to get into science fiction that much, with the exception of explaining how the Starkiller base works, which is that you're sucking up the energy of a star. And that just violates basic astrophysics. Like, there's no way in any universe that would remotely make sense. And I would have preferred when they said, how is it powered? They should have just said, it's magic, because that would have been a more satisfying answer.
As Josh and I know, that's not how physics classes work, but it is how screenwriting classes work. They were putting a clock on the third act.
Yes.
The sheer number of times that we heard in 2 minutes, in 10 minutes, like, giving you a hard clock was nice because it was satisfying to know when this would be done, and also giving you like a when the sun is gone, right. Then they're ready to fire,
right?
Because we haven't seen that before, yeah.
Right, but it it's interesting watching these movies because like the first trilogy were children's movies from back when we let children watch people die. The second trilogy were children's movies from when, like, we could not scare a child, so every enemy had to be a wiseacre droid. Yeah, I'm scared of that. And it's – I don't entirely understand who these movies are pitching themselves to, but the notion of having a clock so clear felt like very much a way of explaining to a seven-year-old watching it. I mean, I'm sure Ella clearly understood when the sun goes out. Like, then they're going to be able to shoot Princess Leia.
But they didn't need the sun to do that because they could just say, oh, they're going to be fully charged in 2 minutes, 10 minutes. I mean, there was already a countdown without us having to see the sun being sucked up, which, again, makes no sense. That this isn't – it doesn't work. Like, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to go with it because it's a film. But
well, it's metaphoric overkill, dark yes. and light, you yes. know, the whole thing. Like, right. and then when the sun diminishes, when the light diminishes, right. darkness will prevail, right. you know, that kind of thing.
But
it's noirish, maybe. Yeah, who knows? Right.
But do you feel like Finn was undercut? That he was I really liked it. I thought that both Boyega and Ridley were like likable and cool and swaggery in a way that felt very appealing, and that it managed to do the joke of he goes to try to rescue her and she does not need rescuing
right.
in the like overblown way that we're used to seeing it. There is this sort of we got into the trope of it's a joke that girl doesn't need help, where this – it just felt more like texture.
Well, I think there's something actually about their youthfulness and energy just, you know, as actors, but also, you know, the characters, right? And both kind of Finn especially encountering the world in a different way, in a
yeah.
different kind of sense of being embodied and all this stuff that made that – work in a way that wasn't just kind of tropey gender stuff, like
right.
you know.
No, the lovely moment when they meet Han Solo and he says the resistance leader and she says no, the smuggler, was just such a beautiful like understanding of the worlds that these people came from, and also the way that this mythology we know so well fits into their world. Finn and let's broaden the conversation to include Poe, who didn't get
totally underdeveloped.
Oh
yeah,
yes,
but great
but
hair.
Yes, also great hair. I kind of loved Poe as a character. Oscar Isaac could have played it so kind of snarky, but he to me it felt like a real sort of flashback to the original film of just a pure G. Willikers kind of character. I mean, yeah, you could say it's one dimensional, but it's also so refreshing in a time when so many. You know, modern action characters are ironic or
yeah.
you know, wry or whatever. And he was just like, nope, he was just a pure good character.
I mean, he was kind of a wry dickbag in that opening interrogation scene. Like, that was yeah. pretty great.
Sure, sure. But, you know, Kylo was being really mean to him. So
I just find Oscar Isaac weird without his beard. I think he looks so much better with facial hair. But that's a lesbian talking, so don't listen to me.
What has he been in with a beard? Because I don't know if I've seen him in anything else that I remember him being in.
He was in what was that folk singer movie that was
–
Inside Llewyn Davis.
Inside Llewyn Davis.
Okay. Bearded.
He was also, bearded in Ex Machina or had facial hair.
Also, I haven't seen either.
I believe we as a pop culture podcast, none of us have watched Show Me a Hero. And
I've watched Show Me a Hero.
I know we
are. He's got the stash, right?
We have failed as a pop culture podcast in that we did not watch it and it was supposed to be amazing. But like John Boyega was so hot in such a different way from what we're used to seeing in movies and Star Wars movies that underscored his youthfulness. It underscored like what a fresh presence he was.
Yeah.
And the sheer number of times that like he pulled two, but him pulling off helmet, sweaty, and like scared of the world around him was just so shocking and exciting. And I wished Oscar Isaac could have gotten just a little bit more of us getting into him, where really he felt like a beefed up Porkins, you know, just like
I think you're thinking of Greg Grunberg as the beefed up Porkins.
Yes.
All the other critiques of the film aside, I think where the film – I will defend the film to its death on the fact that it introduced four characters, new characters, three of whom I thought were developed really, really well, Rey, Finn, and Kylo Ren. If we don't get enough of Poe in this one, I'm assuming he's going to figure more prominently in the next two. But just the fact that they even managed to pull off three engaging, like, sympathetic characters in this film compared to in the prequels where you got exactly zero characters that you ever gave a fuck about, that to me is like a massive accomplishment in and of itself, especially given the weight of the franchise and of the mythology behind it. You know, I'm okay with Poe being a little bit undercooked because
Mace,
he's still pleasurable.
Mace Windu was awesome.
agree to disagree. So, yeah.
All right. I'm going to put forward a theory. I think that there was a cultural contribution from another, like, very successful series that we've had in the past 15 years that really inspired and guided the story. Would anyone like to speculate what it is?
Harry Potter?
Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Yes. Why?
Oh, I don't know, because there's only like three choices.
Rilo's hair.
I mean, I wasn't going to say Fast and Furious, so yeah, what else?
No,
else do I have?
Feel like the Harry Potterification, the Slytherinification of the yeah. First Order was a wonderful choice to the extent that I saw it with the edges of some danger. Snoke particularly feels like a Harry Potter villain.
Mm-hmm. He sounds like the name.
Well, it is Andy Serkis. Yes. Right?
Yes, and that name, Snoke, just feels
terrible.
So outside of their world.
Yeah.
It's interesting. But also putting evil back in the hands of British people. Like
where it belongs.
Where
yes.
it belongs.
Yes.
That, like, making the rank and file of the First Order feel like the old school empire and, you know, not...
We want German costumes and British accents.
Yes.
And God damn it, that is our villain.
Exactly. And they gave it to us and it was satisfying, but I wonder and worry about Snoke.
Wait, worry about what?
Oh, just about like having weird CGI Emperor and also like what this backstory will be, because it is sort of the most J.J. Abrams-y thing that we got out of this movie. In that it varied from the canon. Mm-hmm. And I worry about that going off the rails.
You know, it's funny because with so much familiarity through the rest of the film, I saw Snoke as this weird giant-headed hologram guy. And I was like, oh, okay, well, this is actually something new. I mean,
yeah.
it did feel not familiar to the canon, but I guess I kind of appreciated that. Like, I'm curious to see where this is all going.
I feel like they're clearly building him up to be basically the size or maybe just straight up Gollum, because it's just the hologram of him is so over the
yeah.
top. It's like, you're compensating, dude. Like,
yeah.
really, what's going on with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And actually, I was just going to veer back to just the general Potterification of...
Yes.
of this and thinking about Finn is actually a really adorable dork and a
yeah.
geek, you know, like a hero who's also right. a nerd. And the thing that's really refreshing about it is it's a hero who's a nerd who isn't white.
Yeah.
You know, right. and that's so, you know, and
well,
that, that's
in the
a
same
huge...
week that the Harry Potter play on the West End is going to have a black Hermione.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And Ray is very Hermione, going to go back to that. I mean, mm-hmm. hyper competent, you know.
Yeah. There's something so interesting about. Look, I'm a white guy. I should have been able to watch these Chosen One narratives and in some way, like, identify with them and put myself into them. And I never could, because there was just something so creepily, like, no, I'm not that dude. That it gets very tiring. And there is something interesting about the way Harry Potter gave us a Chosen One and then reminded us constantly that it was the collaboration of the people around him that allowed him to get through this world.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody likes Hermione more than Harry Potter. Right?
Yeah. But I think that that's sort of the success of the introduction of these characters is that they are, I mean, in much the same way that I suppose the original three were supposed to be an ensemble, right?
Uh-huh.
But I think that there's something about, again, maybe even the kind of greater naivete or dorkiness or whatever it is like between and amongst these characters, including Kylo.
Yeah.
I keep thinking Rilo Kiley, the band. So I get really confused, including Kylo, you know, like that there's something about their angst, post-millennial angstiness and also kind of fun lovingness that I don't know, like that allows for a different range of identifications.
Why didn't Ray and Finn kiss in like when they were escaping from the Starkiller
you expect
base?
It. I mean, there was that moment where they go in, you think it's going to be a kiss, yeah. It's a hug instead. I don't know. Maybe they're waiting to build it up. Maybe there'll be like a three-way love triangle between, you know, Ray, Finn, and Poe. Who knows? You kind of expected it, but it wasn't. Let's put it this way: the greatest non-kiss was between Jet Li and Aaliyah in that Jet Li film that Aaliyah was also in.
Yeah,
where it was, that just felt like, oh, that's just racist shit. You just don't want to see an Asian man like kissing a black woman. This kiss, I was like, no, I'm okay with them not kissing. Like,
yeah, I didn't think it had been completely earned yet. It wasn't. Yeah. It didn't feel entirely romantic.
Right.
But I think it is leading that way.
On the subject of hugs and moments, when Rey like got off of the Millennium Falcon after coming back after Han's death, like that moment between her and Leia, and I realized later we would get a literal baton passing. You hate it because she doesn't do anything to tell Chewbacca that she loves him his greatest loss.
She walks right past Chewbacca to hug this girl she just met. It bugged me a little bit.
It really makes no sense. They've never met before. Like, why do they get an emotional moment? That
or
makes no sense.
Have they?
Well, yeah. Okay,
fine.
All right. Now, in this last moment of the main section of our podcast, let us now speculate about the relationship between Rey and the established canon.
Oh, do we have to do this?
No. Yes, we do. Oliver, you go first.
I mean, the most convincing ones I've seen, and let me just be on the record to say that all this speculation is meaningless because we're not going to find out at minimum for another year and a half. And my God, how many fucking pieces on the internet are there going to be written about, like, Rey parentage theories? I mean, to me, it makes the most sense that she's probably Luke's kid. And all right, boom, there, simple. Like someone tried to say no, that she's actually Leia and Han's kid, but they were like force mind wiped to forget that they had a second twin child. I'm like, please God, no.
Josh, theories.
Yes, I think she will probably turn out to be Luke's child. It's possible Leia had her and didn't tell Han, right? But I think that's silly. And this mind wipe thing, that's nonsense.
Yeah, I think Ray is Luke's kid. Luke's love child, intergalactic love child. I have no idea who he met, you know.
I hard believe that she is Leia and Han's child, younger sister of Kylo Ren, who when Kylo went apeshit, Luke was like, uh-oh, we need to hide her so that he will not kill her. And so they sent her to fake Tatooine with fake Ben Kenobi. And the interesting brushstrokes of when you're essentially remaking the movie from 77 of like having things like Han was mostly the Obi-Wan Kenobi of this movie, but having Max von Sydow on Jakku doing God knows what, but still distinctly being the person telling her to calm down when she gets left by her parents. Did you?
Oh, was he?
Yes. I went back and watched.
I was trying to figure out who that was.
No, I went back and watched a second time, mostly just to watch her touching the lightsaber flashbacks.
Right. Same here.
So that you got things like the dude standing behind Kylo Ren, like when Luke grabs R2-D2, there are dudes standing behind him poorly lit, who let's assume are the Knights of Ren who are referenced, like,
even though we never see them outside of that, but yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That it is clearly Max von Sydow's voice.
Okay.
That
is holding her, the young raised child.
Okay. And he's kind of being a dick to her.
Like, yeah.
Calm down. and then what was the other moment there? Let's talk briefly about Phasma. The silver stormtrooper who was Finn's boss. And who does almost nothing except for lower the shields of Starkiller Base. And also, can we even for a moment imagine this character shows up in another film? Because if you lowered the shields of Starkiller Base, well, A, you're dead now. But B, like Kylo Ren would have killed you if you had survived. So why did we hear so much about how like
she was going to be a prominent character. She was heavily in the trailer. She looks cool. And it's like,
yes.
Well, you know, it was a big deal that she was gender swapped. She was written as a man. And then when there was this outcry about the lack of female characters in the new movie, that's when they cast Gwendolyn Christie.
She's the lady who is Brienne of Tarth on Game of Thrones. But why did that character exist?
You needed a sense of what the First Order bureaucracy is like. And so you have managers and managers kind of barking at employees, which is what makes Finn. I don't know.
You needed new stormtrooper outfits that yes. were like completely hierarchized yes. so that you knew if someone was an important stormtrooper.
I think she'll be back. I agree. I'm not sure what she's going to do when she's back, but I think she'll definitely be back.
I can't imagine. If she didn't blow up, Kylo Ren would kill her.
Maybe she's. Maybe
I don't think people
rogue.
Know she's the one who lowered yes, the shields. I think there was so much chaos that, yes. like, you know, and she might be, you know, whatever, struggle with the burden of being, like, of trying to reintegrate herself into the First Order, that kind
All
of
right.
thing.
But what kind of military installation allows a single person to lower the entire defense mechanisms or has no
anyone,
surveillance?
Has anyone.
Right. Any of the interrogation right. rooms?
She was a manager, like, she was, like, the direct supervisor of a guy who worked in sanitation and was an infantry trooper, and she has the capacity to lower the shields?
Yeah, it was all a little – these people, they didn't learn their lessons from Jedi and Star Wars.
Exactly. I mean, there's always one hole. This time it was a bigger, harder hole, but there's always one hole you can shove something in and it will ruin it all.
Should we finish by just a brief bit on Carrie Fisher?
Yes. There was a lot of criticism of her performance. What were your thoughts?
What were the criticisms?
Yeah, I mean, what were – you know, because I totally put myself in this kind of sequestered space, you know, because I wasn't going to see the film until yesterday, which was Monday. And
yeah.
So I haven't seen much about the Carrie Fisher controversies or whatever.
I mean, it was basically just an assertion of she's bad, like, you know – slurring her speech a little bit, as Carrie Fisher always does.
She's done a lot of drugs.
Yes, and also is bipolar and is, like, on a lot of drugs to treat that. I also just think it's not a character we see in films that much. Usually, if we cast an older woman in an action film like this, it is Dame Judi Dench being imperious and above it. And Leia was never above it. Leia was always in it. Mm-hmm. And the first time I watched it, I was a little bit like, oh, Carrie Fisher, you look a little road hard and put away wet. Like, you know, I don't know about this. But the second time I watched it, I realized she's matching Harrison Ford perfectly. Like, she is really giving you exactly the kind of I've seen it all, like gruffness that he is. And I kind of love it. Josh, thoughts?
Yeah, no, I thought she was – it was wonderful to see her. I also saw some of that criticism online, and I've seen a lot of people talking about that they use CGI on her face. Have you seen that?
No, I think that CGI they used on her face was surgeons in the mid-80s.
Well, at first people said, oh, well, her shots were out of focus. And then I saw people say who seemed to know this said, oh, no, they did some CGI –
like post-production.
Yeah, which I think is strange. I mean, I didn't really notice that. But anyway, your main
that's
point
that's
is...
That's just straight-up sexist shit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean...
Harrison Ford was barely trying, but he tried so much more than he's tried in any movie in the past 30 years.
Ooh.
Well, not 30 years. 15, maybe.
I mean, it was better than Indiana.
Since Regarding Henry.
I wanted to give him a space haircut, though.
Yeah.
All right, you are listening to Pop Rocket, the all Star Wars The Force Awakens episode of Pop Rocket. We will be right back to talk about our Star Wars The Force Awakens jams right after this.
Hi, I'm Mark.
And I'm Hal, and we're the hosts of We Got This,
the show that offers definitive answers to dumb debates that you suggest.
Every Wednesday, we discuss the hot-button topics you never knew you cared so much about, like whether you should put ketchup on a hot dog.
What's the best Star Wars movie?
Whether it's better to be too hot or too cold.
Coke or Pepsi?
Best Marvel movie.
Which is the best religion?
I told you we're not doing that one.
So join us every week on MaximumFun.org, and don't worry, everyone. We got this.
We got this.
Welcome back to International Waters. I'm Guy Branum. I'm here in the studio with
Karen Tongson,
Josh Greenberg,
Oliver Wang.
And we are talking about Star Wars on this episode. And every week on Pop Rocket, we ask a question. Josh, you may not be familiar with this, but the question we ask is, what's your current jam? Now, because this is an all Star Wars episode, unfortunately, we are not allowing you to talk about what your current general services jam is. I want you to tell me, what is your current Star Wars jam?
Okay. Well, my current Star Wars jam, which coincidentally is also my current jam in real life, is Ewok Celebration. The original Ewok Celebration sung by the Ewoks in Return of the Jedi, also known as Yub Nub, which was a great song, and then for no apparent reason was replaced in those horrible special editions with a really bland Ewok song.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was called Village Celebration when it was replaced.
Let's hear it.
Sure.
So was it just like the standard criticism of the Ewoks as being too childish that got this replaced?
Yes, yes, exactly. Because the one that it was replaced with is very kind of sullen and boring, and it sounds like the Ewoks are all on drugs.
Fuck this. I feel like so much fanboyness comes down to people being angry that children exist and they are not children anymore.
Yes, yes.
Why is it for them, this movie that is for children?
I feel like Shakira could totally remake this song.
Yeah, absolutely.
God, yes. My biggest fantasy and fear is that Shakira's lyrics make so much sense in Spanish.
Real quick, though, because Josh, you said I didn't even know that Yub Nub had an English translation. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, there was an English language version of that song, lyrics by John Williams' son, and they're really creepy. The lyrics to the song sound a bit like a fascist anthem. Where they're singing, at first they're just singing, yay, this is a celebration. But then they're singing about power and how great it is to wield the power. It's a very
wonderful.
Peculiar choice. Yes.
While we're having a moment of Return of the Jedi nostalgia, may I just say to the universe that C-3PO's cereal really was the finest cereal I've ever consumed in my life. And I miss it greatly. And I have a distinct memory, Karen, of watching Gandhi on a top-loading VCR.
Oh, wow.
While eating C-3PO cereal, which may be the most 1983 memory possible.
That is very 1983. It's your Proustian Madeleine, yes. That moment right there.
Karen, what is your Star Wars jam?
Well, so obviously my Star Wars jam from the films is, of course, you know, everybody's favorite Star Wars jam, the Cantina song,
yeah.
And also the variations on that Cantina too, which is a little more big bandy with swinging horns and steel drums. But what we might not realize is that John Williams also wrote jazz. And,
yeah.
You know, a lot of folks maybe in the Star Wars universe don't know this.
I had no idea.
And he, you know, wrote probably his best composition was with Alan Bergman from, you know, the Bergman songwriting team. And it's called Make Me Rainbows. And it's a swinging little number that Ella Fitzgerald popularized in these live recordings from Brazil. And so let's bring on a little bit of John Williams' grooving side.
In the snow, make me beautiful music wherever I go. Make me unwind, leave behind rhyme or reason.
Well, so you get a little flavor for how, you know, as a composer, he was so facile and versatile and could do, you know, a range of things from the celebratory Ewok Shakira-like number to, you know, the kind of jazzier tunes we picked up from the Cantina. And I think that it's just, you know, it's good to hear John Williams in a defamiliarized way doing this stuff for real.
Yeah. Oliver, what's your Star Wars jam?
So my favorite part of the Williams score, I think outside of the main theme, which really only best works in that just when the film starts and the Star Wars comes on screen and fades in the background, you know, my other favorite part of his entire score is – and it goes by variation names. It actually kind of – you hear the motif, the leitmotif in the Princess Leia theme. It's most pronounced in the Han Solo and the Princess theme, which you hear throughout Empire Strikes Back. But my favorite moment in which that motif returns is what's known as the Rebel Fleet theme, which is at the very end of Empire Strikes Back. When Leia and Luke are standing on the medical frigate brig and looking out the window at the Millennium Falcon piloted by Chewie and Lando flying off to Tatooine to try to rescue Han. And the theme itself is always incredibly melancholy. And that moment is because, you know, Luke's just lost his hand. He's discovered his father's Darth Vader. Han's frozen in carbonite. And it's this moment where it's kind of a downer moment. It's not what you expect because it has none of the triumph of the first film. And it's just shot beautifully because you have this amazing spiral galaxy that the Falcon is flying across and the Rebel fleet and the camera angles. And there's this swell of the Rebel theme, which, again, it's recalling the Han and Leia theme, and it just works beautifully. So I actually took this clip. It's not from the original studio score. It's actually from when it's used in the movie. So you'll hear the Falcon powering up, and you'll hear Chewie and some of the other characters briefly in the background. So if I had to pick the most emotionally sublime moment in the entire franchise, I think it's really these last 2 minutes from Empire Strikes Back. And yeah, I just every time I hear it, I just love that chord, those melodies. Yeah.
I haven't seen Empire Strikes Back like since the 80s. I need to rewatch it. My Star Wars jam is not from Star Wars. It is from Aaron Copland, who John Williams is a big fan of and who he cribbed a lot of stuff from and who I love very much, not the least of which for the fact that he was a Jewish homosexual. Let's hear some Rodeo.
You can totally hear the how Williams cribbed from this. I mean,
yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Only this time, it wasn't about a fascist dictatorship. It was about a girl who wanted to ride a horse like a cowboy.
That's very appropriate to The Force Awakens.
Yeah. Very appropriate to The Force Awakens. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Oliver Wang, Karen Tongson, and Josh Greenberg. We will post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to the 5-star reviews on iTunes that we don't have because we recorded this the same day as we did the previous one, and we used all of the names for that. But this point remains that you guys should give us a 5-star review on iTunes, and this time you should mention how great Karen and Josh were because they were really great. Please review us. Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket, join our Facebook group, and have your say on our Star Wars spoiler thread. But most importantly, remember, many boffins died to bring you this episode. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the now-returned Colin Anderson.
Huzzah.
It's nice to have him back, who has officially stated he would like to see someone who has amazing force powers who isn't related to the royal family.
Yes.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.